You're listening to the Partisan Comms Podcast.
There is a signal broadcast every second of every day through our television sets.
Welcome to Episode 6. I'm Terrence. The Roman Empire was one of the largest and most powerful civilizations in history, spanning over 3 continents and lasting for more than 1,000 years. It reached its peak of glory and prosperity in the 2nd century CE under the rule of the 5 good emperors, who are considered the best rulers of the Roman Empire because they brought prosperity to the empire during their respective reigns. However, by the 5th century CE, the empire had collapsed, leaving behind a legacy of cultural, legal, and political influence, but also many questions regarding what caused its downfall. Historians have proposed various theories and factors that contributed to the fall of the Roman Empire, such as political instability, economic decline, military weakness, social decay, religious change, and external pressure. However, there is no consensus on which factor was the most decisive. Moreover, some historians argue the Roman Empire didn't fall at all, but rather transformed into different political entities, such as the Byzantine Empire in the east and the Germanic kingdoms in the west. In this episode, we'll discuss some of the causes of the fall of the Roman Empire and compare and contrast them with the current political, economic, military, and social conditions of the United States of America. We'll also discuss the similarities and differences between the two empires and the implications and challenges for the future of the United States and the world. This episode won't be an exhaustive list of every cause of the Romans' decline, because the issues presented here are complex, especially if we weigh them against our present society's issues. But perhaps it will serve as an effective high-level discussion of what causes empires to fall, what are the warning signs, and if we can learn from these examples, then perhaps America can avoid a similar fate.
Part 1. Political Instability.
Many Roman leaders used imagery, literature, the construction of monuments and infrastructure projects, artwork, and coins to boast an image of strength, wealth, and glory. Memorializing the greatness of the state, its society, and culture is a practice countries around the world still use today, and America is no exception. Throughout our nearly 250-year history, America's leaders have set the tone and direction of the country through numerous political speeches, culture, as well as government-funded initiatives and projects to project an image of power and greatness.
Winston Churchill said the destiny of man is not measured by material computations. When great forces are on the move in the world, we learn we're spirits, not animals. And he said there's something going on in time and space and beyond time and space, which, whether we like it or not, spells duty. You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
The purpose of protecting the life of our nation and preserving the liberty of our citizens is to pursue the happiness of our people. Our success in that pursuit is the test of our success as a nation. For a century, we labored to settle and to subdue a continent. For half a century, we called upon unbounded invention and untiring energy to create an order of plenty for all of our people. The challenge of the next half century is whether we have the wisdom to use that wealth to enrich and elevate our national life.
Choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard. Because that goal will serve to organize and measure the best of our energies and skills.
Your imagination and your initiative and your indignation will determine whether we build a society where progress is the servant of our needs, are a society where old values and new visions are buried under unbridled growth. For in your time, we have the opportunity to move not only toward the rich society and the powerful society, but upward to the great society.
I've spoken of the Shining City all my political life, but I don't know if I ever quite communicated what I saw when I said it. But in my mind, it was a tall, proud city built on rocks stronger than oceans, windswept, God-blessed, and teeming with people of all kinds living in harmony and peace. A city with pre-ports that hummed with commerce and creativity. And if there had to be city walls, the walls had doors, and the doors were open to anyone with the will and the heart to get here.
From the cities to the suburbs to the loneliest town on the quietest street, to take our message of hope and growth for every American, to every American, I will keep America moving forward, always forward, for a better America, for an endless, enduring dream and 1,000 points of light.
Many years ago, the great British explorer George Mallory, who was to die on Mount Everest, was asked why did he want to climb it. He said, because it is there. Well, space is there, and we're going to climb it. And the moon and the planets are there, and new hopes for knowledge and peace are there. And therefore, as we set sail, we ask God's blessing on the most hazardous and dangerous and greatest adventure on which man has ever embarked.
America is today the strongest, the most influential, and most productive nation in the world. Understandably proud of this preeminence, we yet realize that America's leadership and prestige depend not merely upon our unmatched material progress, riches, and military strength, but on how we use our power in the interest of world peace and human betterment.
Other examples of similarities between the Roman and American empires include the challenge of managing a military force effectively across a widespread geographical area, as well as navigating various social and political instances of instability across their respective territories. Political instability within the Roman Empire was an important factor that contributed to its decline and ultimate fall. The empire faced a series of challenges and crises that undermined its authority, legitimacy, and cohesion. These challenges and crises included civil wars, usurpations, assassinations, secession disputes, corruption, division, and external threats. One of the causes of their instability was the lack of a clear and consistent system of succession. Unlike other ancient civilizations such as Egypt or China, the Romans did not have a hereditary monarchy or a legal code that regulated the transfer of power from one emperor to another. Instead, the succession was often based on personal or military factors such as adoption, nomination, election, or conquest. This created uncertainty and ambiguity about who was the rightful heir or ruler of the empire, and it opened the door for rivalries and conflicts among the potential successors. In contrast to the Roman system of succession, America's constitutional republic has a written process which defines the peaceful transfer of power from one administration to the next, as well as a line of succession of cabinet officers should the president become unable to fulfill the duties and responsibilities of the executive branch of government. Although the framers of the Constitution did flirt with the idea of having a king, and had our country proceeded with creating a monarchy style of government, it's conceivable future generations of Americans could have run into similar issues of dealing with an inconsistent succession system like the Romans experienced. One of the consequences of the political instability of the Roman Empire was the frequent occurrence of civil wars and revolts. Civil wars were armed conflicts between different factions or groups within the empire, usually over the issue of who should be the emperor or how the empire should be governed. Civil wars were costly and destructive, as they drained the resources, manpower, and morale of the empire. Civil wars also weakened the unity and loyalty of the empire, as they divided the people, the army, and the provinces along political, ethnic, or religious lines. Another example of political instability was the crisis of the 3rd century. This was a period of about 50 years from 235 to 284 CE, when the empire faced a series of political, military, economic, and social problems that threatened its survival. During this period, the empire had more than 20 emperors, most of whom were killed or overthrown by their rivals or the army. The empire also faced invasions and raids by barbarian tribes, such as the Goths or the Franks, and they also exploited the weakness and chaos of the empire. The empire also suffered from inflation, taxation, and corruption, which eroded the prosperity and stability of the empire. The Romans also experienced religious and cultural changes, such as the rise of Christianity and the emergence of regional identities, which challenged the traditional values and institutions of the empire. The political instability of the Roman Empire affected its fate and legacy, and it led it to the loss of territory, power, and influence, and the transformation of the empire into different political entities, such as the Byzantine Empire in the east and the Germanic kingdoms in the west. This instability also influenced the history and culture of the world, as it shaped the development of Europe, the Middle East, and North Africa.
Part 2. Military Decline.
The decline of the military was another important reason that contributed to the fall of the empire. The Roman army was once the most formidable and disciplined force in the world, but it became weak, corrupt, and disloyal as it faced various internal and external challenges. These challenges included the loss of manpower, the lack of training and equipment, the rise of barbarian enemies, and consequences from their civil wars and usurpations. One of the causes of Rome's military decline was the loss of manpower. The army depended on a large and steady supply of soldiers who were recruited from the citizenry in the provinces. However, the empire's population declined due to various factors such as wars, plagues, famines, and migrations. The recruitment of soldiers also became more difficult and costly, as the citizens and the provincials lost their loyalty and enthusiasm for the empire. The army also suffered from high casualties and desertions, which reduced its numbers and quality. Another consequence of this decline was the lack of training and equipment. The Roman army was known for its rigorous and professional training, which gave it an edge over its enemies. The army also had access to superior weapons, armor, and siege engines, which enhanced its effectiveness and efficiency. However, the training and equipment of the army deteriorated due to various reasons, such as the shortage of funds, the corruption of the officers, and the negligence of the emperors. The army also became more dependent on foreign mercenaries, who were often poorly trained and equipped, and who had different tactics and cultures. The decline of the Roman military was highlighted by losses such as the Battle of Adrianople in 378 CE, and this was a decisive battle between the Roman army and the Goths, a barbarian tribe that had invaded the empire. The Roman army, led by Emperor Valens, was outnumbered, outmaneuvered, and outfought by the Goths, who had superior cavalry and archery. The Roman army suffered a crushing defeat, and Valens was killed. The battle marked the end of the dominance of the Roman army and the beginning of the rise of the barbarian kingdoms. The army also faced the problem of defense and security, as it was unable to protect the vast and vulnerable borders of the empire from the constant attacks of barbarian tribes like the Goths, also the Huns, as well as the Vandals. Moreover, they were unable to cope with the new and emerging threats and technologies of warfare. The United States also faces similar issues, despite having the most powerful and advanced military in the world. Its military is overstretched, it's underworked, underpaid, and underappreciated, and it is involved in multiple and endless conflicts and missions around the world. Like the Romans, the American military also faces the problem of recruitment and retention as it struggles to attract and keep qualified and motivated personnel. The military also faces the problem of morale and ethics as it deals with the issues of mental health, suicide, and sexual assault. Moreover, the military has the challenge of adapting to the new and emerging threats and technologies of warfare, such as cyber warfare and the use of drones. America, like the Romans, has also been on their share of the losing side of conflicts, and some of America's adversaries have pointed to those as a sign of a military in decline. Like the Romans, the empire takes great pride in its military prowess. However, it must overcome obstacles related to technological advances of its adversaries and sustaining readiness of their forces during declines in recruitment in order to maintain its edge over potential adversaries.
We set sail on this new sea because there is new knowledge to be gained and new rights to be won, and they must be won and used for the progress of all people. For space science, like nuclear science and all technology, has no conscience of its own. Whether it will become a force for good or ill depends on man, and only if the United States occupies a position of preeminence can we help decide whether this new ocean will be a sea of peace or a new terrifying theater of war.
The martyrs of history were not fools, and our honored dead who gave their lives to stop the advance of the Nazis didn't die in vain. Where then is the road to peace? Well, it's a simple answer after all. You and I have the courage to say to our enemies, there is a price we will not pay, there is a point beyond which they must not advance.
My fellow Americans, as President and Commander-in-Chief, it is my duty to the American people to report that renewed hostile actions against United States ships on the high seas in the Gulf of Tonkin have today required me to order the military forces of the United States to take action in reply.
Just 2 hours ago, Allied air forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait. These attacks continue as I speak.
You've been listening to some of the coverage provided for us by our affiliate WABC out of New York City. Let's go now and check our other affiliate WNBC to get the latest. I'm sorry, WNYW here, live coverage here of this amazing picture we're getting from Lower Manhattan. Two planes, one hitting each of the Twin Towers at the World Trade Center.
I can hear you. The rest of the world hears you. And the people... and the people who knocked these buildings down will hear all of us soon.
On Sunday, June 25th, Communist forces attacked the Republic of Korea. 52 of the 59 countries which are members of the United Nations have given their support to the action taken by the Security Council to restore peace in Korea. Under the flag of the United Nations, a unified command has been established for all forces of the members of the United Nations fighting in Korea. General Douglas MacArthur is the commander of this combined force.
Their lives ended in places called Belleau Wood, the Argonne, Omaha Beach, Salerno, and halfway around the world on Guadalcanal, Tarawa, Porkchop Hill, the Chosin Reservoir, and in 100 rice paddies and jungles of a place called Vietnam.
And now to honor America, especially the brave men and women serving our nation in the Persian Gulf and throughout the world, please join in the singing of our national anthem.
On July 16th, the last day Congress was in session, Washington was on edge. Thousands of angry veterans surrounded the Capitol. Near midnight, the 72nd Congress adjourned. Congressmen left through back doors and underground tunnels to avoid confrontations. The situation had come to a head. The president ordered the evacuation of the veterans from downtown Washington.
When MacArthur moved his troops to the affected area, he knew exactly what he was going to do. And he adorned himself in his dress uniform along with his major aide, Dwight D. Eisenhower.
The force stepped off at 4:30 p.m. More than 200 cavalrymen spread out across Constitution and Pennsylvania Avenues. Behind them came 400 infantrymen, followed up by tanks and armored vehicles.
And the roaring flames sound the death knell to the fantastic Bonus Army that ends so disastrously in the shadow of the capital of the United States of America.
As we know, the spending plan would shrink the Army to its smallest size since the 1930s, before World War II.
Tonight, Fox 13 investigates troubling claims from local veterans. They say they are still, after all these years, facing excessive wait times for benefits and health care.
And federal records show many may have died waiting. And a former VA insider from Tampa Bay now speaking out.
Welcome back. Topping the news at the bottom of the hour, suicide rates among military personnel and veterans are climbing to new highs. That is according to an alarming report by Brown University's Cost of War Project.
But we can no longer risk emergency improvisation of national defense. We have been compelled to create a permanent armaments industry of vast proportions. Added to this, 3.5 million men and women are directly engaged in the defense establishment. We annually spend on military security alone more than the net income of all United States corporations. Now, this conjunction of an immense military establishment and a large arms industry is new in the American experience. The total influence, economic, political, even spiritual, is felt in every city, every state house, every office of the federal government. We recognize the imperative need for this development, yet we must not fail to comprehend its grave implications.
Whoever does not have the stomach for this fight, let him depart. Pay him his money to speed his departure, since we wish not to die in this man's company. Whoever returns safely tomorrow morning will rouse himself every year on that day. Show his neighbors scars and tell them villainous stories of all their great feats of battle. And these stories you will teach your son. And from this day until the end of the time, we shall be remembered.
We have you. We band of brothers. Whoever sheds his blood with me shall forever be my brother.
And those men too afraid to go think themselves lesser men, as they have heard how we have fought and died together.
This will be the last time that we're together in mass before we cross the line of departure. We might not all make it back. We need to come to terms with that. The strength of the wolf is the pack. The strength of the pack is the wolf. You have to be able to rely on that Marine to your left and right, and he has got to be able to rely on you. you're an atheist, play along. The power of prayer is exactly that. Please bow your heads.
America's adversaries have referred to and been critical of protracted military operations in the Middle East in countries like Iraq and Afghanistan, which do not appear to have a defined end date or definition of victory as a sign of failure and dysfunction. Critics of American military intervention will often point to involvement in conflicts such as the Korean War from 1950 to 1953. The war was part of the global struggle against communism. America intervened to prevent the fall of South Korea to communists, but they faced a bloody and costly war that reached a stalemate. The war ended with an armistice, not a peace treaty, and the division of Korea along the 38th parallel. The war was a draw for America and its allies, and a stalemate for the communists and their allies. The war also caused millions of deaths, injuries, and left Korea divided and tense. Another example America's adversaries cite is the Vietnam War from 1955 to 1975. Once again, America intended to intervene to prevent one side of a conflict from falling to a communist adversary. This time it was to prevent the fall of South Vietnam to communism, but faced a fierce and protracted guerrilla war that eroded its political will. America began to withdraw its military in 1973, and South Vietnam eventually fell to the communists in 1975. The war was a defeat for America and its allies and a victory for the communists and theirs. Like the Korean War, it caused millions of deaths, injuries, and left lasting scars on both sides.
Part 3. Economic and Social Decline.
The final two factors I'll discuss which contributed to the fall of the Roman Empire were economic and social decline. The empire suffered from inflation, taxation, and debt, which eroded the wealth and prosperity of the people. The Roman Empire also depended on slave labor, which reduced the productivity and innovation of the economy. The empire also faced the problem of trade and commerce, as it was disrupted by wars, piracy, and corruption. Moreover, they were unable to sustain their massive military and administrative expenditures, which drained their resources and revenues. They also experienced social and environmental problems such as poverty, inequality, disease, and famine. Many historians point to Rome's decline in morals and values as an important reason for their decline. Toward the last years of the empire, the citizens were excessive with promiscuity, overindulgent parties, and violence, which all contributed to the moral decline. The social decline of the Roman Empire was a complex and gradual process that involved many dynamics. As the empire expanded, the gap between the rich and poor grew wider, leading to a decline in social cohesion. The ruling elite became increasingly detached from the common people, and corruption permeated various levels of society. The traditional values of patriotism, duty, and justice were replaced by greed, luxury, and self-interest. The Roman citizens became more dependent on the state and less willing to participate in civic affairs. The Roman family was the basic unit of society and the source of loyalty, discipline, and education. However, the family structure was weakened by divorce, infidelity, abortion, and infanticide, which were common practices among the upper classes. The lower classes also suffered from poverty, disease, and slavery, which disrupted their family lives. Christianity, which emerged as a new religion in the first century CE, offered a new sense of community, identity, and hope to the oppressed and marginalized. However, it also challenged the authority and legitimacy of the Roman state, which was based on pagan worship and emperor worship. The Roman Empire was a multicultural and multilingual entity that assimilated and integrated various peoples and cultures from different regions. The Roman culture was enriched by the contributions of the Greeks and the Egyptians and others. However, as the empire declined, the cultural diversity and creativity also diminished. The Roman education system became ineffectual, and Roman literature and art became repetitive and imitative. The Roman language, Latin, also lost its vitality and variety and split into different dialects that eventually evolved into the Romance languages.
Part 4. Decline of the American Empire.
The U.S. has the largest and most diversified economy in the world and is the main driver of global trade and investment. However, its economic growth and stability are affected by various factors such as increasing debt, unfunded liabilities, and high inflation.
Good evening. This is a special night for me. Exactly 3 years ago, on July 15th, 1976, I accepted the nomination of my party to run for President of the United States. I promised you a president who is not isolated from the people, who feels your pain and who shares your dreams and who draws his strength and his wisdom from you. During the past 3 years, I've spoken to you on many occasions about national concerns, the energy crisis, reorganizing the government, our nation's economy, and issues of war, and especially peace. But over those years, the subjects of the speeches, the talks, and the press conferences have become increasingly narrow, focused more and more on what the isolated world of Washington thinks is important. It's clear that the true problems of our nation are much deeper, deeper than gasoline lines or energy shortages, deeper even than inflation or recession.
We were young, the future was so bright. Whoa. The whole neighborhood was so alive. Whoa. And every kid on the whole damn street, whoa, was gonna make it big and not be beat. Now the neighborhood's cracked and torn. Whoa. The kids are grown up but their lives are won.
To follow Rome, one of the greatest civilizations of all time, as it degenerated and fractured, is especially painful in view of the parallels to what is happening in America in our own times. Close quote.
Yeah.
What are the parallels that are most striking to you?
The internal loss of confidence, that we're not prepared to stand up and defend ourselves. I mean, there are all kinds of small signs and large signs, but that we have to accommodate people who move here. You know, the old saying was that when in Rome, do as the Romans do. The new one is, when in Rome, tell the Romans what to do. Mm. And we're going along with it.
The collapse of a civilization is not just the replacement of rulers or institutions with new rulers and new institutions. It is the destruction of a whole way of life and the painful and sometimes pathetic attempts of rebuilding amid the ruins. Is that where America is headed? I believe it is. Close quote. Now, whatever troubles we have, it's still the richest, most powerful nation in the world. We're still fundamentally at peace, some soldiers in Iraq, some soldiers in Afghanistan, some in Germany, some in South Korea, but relatively small wars by historical standards in Afghanistan and Iraq. How can you say such a thing?
Well, you know, that description would also have fit the United States on December 6, 1941. So it's like the argument that was used when I used to question whether Social Security was fiscally sound. And I said, Social Security has never missed a payment. It's never been a day late or a dollar short. I said, that's always true, right up to the moment of collapse.
This city, 50 miles east of Los Angeles, had already slashed salaries and cut 20% of its employees. San Bernardino still faced a $45 million deficit when the city council called for an emergency session and voted to file for bankruptcy.
It is a crisis of confidence. It is a crisis that strikes at the very heart and soul and spirit of our national will. We can see this crisis in the growing doubt about the meaning of our own lives and in the loss of a unity of purpose for our nation. The erosion of our confidence in the future is threatening to destroy the social and the political fabric of America. The confidence that we have always had as a people is not simply some romantic dream or a proverb in a dusty book that we read just on the 4th of July. It is the idea which founded our nation and has guided our development as a people. Confidence in the future has supported everything else. Public institutions and private enterprise, our own families, and the very Constitution of the United States. Confidence has defined our course.
I can walk little street, swallow so many lies. Chances grown, nothing's free. Longing for what used to be. Still it's hard, hard to see. Fragile lives, shattered dreams.
San Bernardino is a blue-collar city of construction workers and factory employees, hit hard by the housing collapse and recession.
We're back now with a record number of migrants crossing into the U.S., pushing resources to the limit in many American cities. Now hospitals are sounding the alarm, saying they're also overwhelmed, including some far from the border.
New York Mayor Eric Adams saying providing services for migrants will cost city taxpayers $12 billion.
It's a grim outlook for the state's future as many state and local leaders gather on Mackinac Island for the annual policy conference. One thing top of mind for leaders there, the state's population decline.
And a record 3 million migrants crossed the border in the last year.
And I think the first question is over here.
Yes, I'd like to direct my question to Mr. Perot. What will you do as president to open foreign markets to fair competition from American business and establish here at home from foreign countries so that we can bring jobs back to the United States?
That's right at the top of my agenda. We've shipped millions of jobs overseas, and we have a strange situation because we have a process in Washington where after you've served for a while, you cash in, become a foreign lobbyist, make $30,000 a month, then take a leave, work on presidential campaigns, make sure you got good contacts, and then go back out. Now, if you just want to get down to brass tacks, first thing you ought to do is get all these folks who've got these one-way trade agreements that we've negotiated over the years, and say, fellas, we'll take the same deal we gave you. And they'll gridlock right at that point. Because, for example, we've got international competitors who simply could not unload their cars off the ships if they had to comply. You see, if it was a two-way street, just couldn't do it. We have got to stop sending jobs overseas. To those of you in the audience who are business people, pretty simple. If you're paying $12, $13, $14 an hour for factory workers, and you can move your factory south of the border, pay a dollar an hour for labor, hire a young 25, that's assume you've been in business for a long time, you've got a mature workforce. Pay a dollar an hour for your labor, have no health care, that's the most expensive single element making a car, have no environmental controls, no pollution controls, and no retirement, and you don't care about anything but making money, there will be a giant sucking sound going south. So if the people send me to Washington, the first thing I'll do is study that 2,000-page agreement and make sure it's a two-way street. One last point here. I decided I was dumb and didn't understand it, so I called a who's who of the folks who've been around it, and I said, why won't everybody go south? They said, we'll be disruptive. I said, for how long? I finally got them up for 12 to 15 years, and I said, well, how does it stop being disruptive? And that is when their jobs come up from a dollar an hour to $6 an hour and ours go down to $6 an hour, then it's leveled again. But in the meantime, you've wrecked the country with these kinds of deals. We've got to cut it out.
Thank you, Mr. Perot. I see that the president...
Blocked by Barack Obama when he was president.
The State Department has decided that the Keystone XL pipeline would not serve the national interests of the United States.
Reinstated by Donald Trump.
I am pleased to announce the official approval of the presidential permit for the Keystone XL pipeline.
Joe Biden canceled the key permit for the project on his very first day in office.
Amy had a chance, what she really did. Whoa. Instead she dropped out and had a couple of kids. Whoa. Maxi lives at home cause he got no job. He just plays guitar and smokes a lot of pot. Jay committed suicide. Whoa. Brandon OD'd and died. Whoa. What the hell is going on?
Middle class citizenship is crucial in the history of constitutional government. Unfortunately, in our generation, it's eroding, and we can see it erode in a variety of contexts. The first is, for 10 years, average wages of the middle class did not rise. 50% of the country dies with less than $10,000 in aggregate wealth. Over half of Americans die with credit card debt. Their buying options are limited. Their choices on how they live are limited. Their chances at home ownership decline.
Like the Roman Empire, the American Empire faces its own set of complex economic challenges which could contribute to decline. The country suffers from high unemployment, inflation, and debt, which affect the living standards and opportunities of its people. America also depends on foreign labor, which creates dependency and vulnerability in the economy. Another ongoing challenge is navigating complicated globalization and trade issues, as well as competition from the rise of other economies such as China, India, and Brazil, as well as monetary threats such as the introduction of new currencies aimed at supplanting the U.S. dollar. Additionally, America struggles with balancing its budget, reducing its deficits, and if left unresolved, over time will limit its financial and monetary options. According to 2020 data from the World Bank, the U.S. is ranked first in the world for the gross domestic product, which measures the total value of goods and services produced in a country, but 10th for the GDP per capita, which measures the average income of a person in a country. In the 2020 IMD World Competitiveness Center report, which measures the ability of a country to foster an environment of sustainable growth, America ranked 10th in the world for competitiveness, down from the first place in 2018. The current political instability in America is a serious and complicated problem that threatens the stability and prosperity of the nation both in the short and long term. The United States is facing a series of challenges and crises that undermine its governance and cohesion. These challenges include ongoing political instability, polarization, social and moral decline, gridlock, corruption, violence, and external threats.
Some people have been on the ride for a long time, and they begin to question, is this real, or is this just a ride? And other people have remembered, and they come back to us, and they say, hey, don't worry, don't be afraid, ever, because this is just a ride. And we kill those people.
Shut him up. We have a lot invested in this ride. Shut him up. Look at my furrows of worry. Look at my big bank account and my family. This has to be real.
It's just a ride. But we always kill those good guys who try and tell us that. You ever notice that? And let the demons run amok?
In Dallas, Texas, three shots were fired at President Kennedy's motorcade in downtown Dallas. The first reports say that President Kennedy has been seriously wounded by this shooting.
As I turned around quickly, and the next thing I saw was Malcolm falling back in a dead faint.
Apparently, two men approached the speaker's rostrum and discharged shots at him from apparently very close range.
Good evening. Dr. Martin Luther King, the apostle of nonviolence in the civil rights movement, has been shot to death in Memphis, Tennessee.
Robert Francis Kennedy was 42 years old and had just won the victory of his political life in the California presidential primary. He spoke to his supporters, heard their cheers, and invited them to Chicago. Senator Kennedy was a very happy man as he made his way out of the crowd into the hotel kitchen, into the range of a young, swarthy assailant. The senator was hit by two bullets. Five other persons were also wounded as bullets sprayed the kitchen. Only the senator was critically hurt.
Good grief. Look at that.
11. That means automatic recount.
Suspense is mounting in Florida tonight.
Probably at least 500 people outside. Spirited demonstrators both for Bush and Gore.
The presidential race of 2000 turned the American experiment on its head.
For what purpose does the gentlewoman from California, Ms. Waters, arise?
Mr. Vice President, I rise to object to the fraudulent 25 Florida electoral votes.
Is the objection in writing and signed by a member of the House and a senator?
The objection is in writing, and I don't care that it is not signed by a member of the Senate.
The chair will advise that the rules do care, and
after four long, tense days, we've reached a historic moment in this election. We can now project the winner of the presidential race. CNN projects Joseph R. Biden Jr. is elected the 46th president of the United States.
If you see anybody from that cabinet in a restaurant, in a department store, at a gasoline station, you get out and you create a crowd. And you push back on them. And you tell them they're not welcome.
Last June, a gunman wielding a semi-automatic assault rifle opened fire on Republican lawmakers practicing for a charity baseball game in suburban Virginia.
Tonight, Rand Paul still out of the public eye after that stunning attack.
One of the causes of the present political instability is polarization. The division and hostility of the society along partisan, ideological, and cultural lines makes it difficult to reach consensus or compromise on major issues. Polarization is driven by various factors such as the rise in influence of social media, the decline of traditional media, the influence of money and interest groups, the sorting of voters and communities, and the manipulation of electoral rules.
The American Negro is nothing but a political football, and the white liberals control this ball through tricks or tokenism, false promises of integration and civil rights. In this game of deceiving and using the American Negro, the white liberals have complete cooperation of the Negro civil rights leader, who sell our people out for a few crumbs of token recognition, token gains, token progress.
Well, I've been selling my soul, working all day, overtime hours for bullshit pay, so I can sit out here and waste my life away, drag back home and drown my troubles away.
I was continually asking myself, why did some societies solve problems that destroyed other societies? Why did the leaders of some societies make good decisions and not in other cases? And eventually struck me that I think a distinction between societies that succeed or fail to solve their problems, on the average, has to do with the role of the elite, the politicians, the wealthy people in a society. A society whose decision makers, whose wealthy people, are able to insulate themselves from the consequences of their actions for the broader society. Such a society has a recipe for disaster, because the elite are likely to make decisions in their own short-term interests, but disastrous in the long run for society as a whole, because the politicians are not in the short run feeling the consequences of their actions. Whereas a society whose decision makers cannot insulate themselves from the consequences of their actions have leaders motivated to solve society's problems because they are affected by them. As an example, one might wonder, why on earth did the Maya kings not just look out the windows of their palaces around the year AD 800 and see the deforestation on the hillsides and the soil erosion on the hillsides, removing agricultural land and soil piling up in the valley bottoms? Why didn't the Maya kings just say, stop it, and halt the deforestation and soil erosion in time? The Maya kings may not have been motivated to solve those environmental problems of Maya society, because the Maya kings had succeeded in their palaces in insulating themselves from the consequences of their actions. Namely, the kings were continuing to eat well from food brought to them as tribute by the commoners, and the kings were still building palaces and erecting monuments with the labor of the commoners, even while the commoners themselves were getting malnourished and eventually starving, until it was too late, and the commoners rose in revolt and overthrew the kings and burned their palaces. So the kings had insulated themselves in the short run from broader problems of Maya society, but not in the long run.
in an editorial dated February the 5th, 1960, they pointed out that out of 11 million qualified Negro voters, only 2,700,000 actually take time to vote. This means that, roughly speaking, only 3 million out of the 11 million Negroes who are qualified to vote take an active part. And the remaining 8 million remain voluntarily inactive. And yet it is this small minority, the 3 million Negro voters, who help determine who will be the next president. If who will be the next president can be influenced by 3 million Negro voters, it is easy to see why the presidential candidates of both political parties put on such a false show with the Civil Rights Bill and promises of integration. They must impress the 3 million voting Negroes who are the actual integration seekers. And if so much fuss is made over these 3 million integration seekers, what would the presidential candidates have to do to appease the 8 million non-voting Negroes if they ever decided to become politically active? They hold the balance of power.
Whenever one tries, as I have, to draw lessons from history that could help us in dealing with problems we face today, if we would like our modern society to solve problems as did successful past societies, and not to fall into the errors that drag down other past societies, you have to be aware of differences between the past and present. It's not straightforward to extrapolate lessons from the past to the present, because one could say, today we got a whole new ball game. The present is unlike the past. There are big differences. And it's true, you can't just straightforwardly reason from the past to the present without taking account of the differences between the past and present. Some of those differences between past societies and present societies are ones that make our current situation much more dangerous than in the past and would incline us towards pessimism or even fatalism.
These rich men know the rich men, Lord knows they all just wanna have total control. Wanna know what you think, wanna know what you do, and they don't think you know, but I know that you do. Cause your dollar ain't shit, and it's taxed to no end, cause a rich man.
I think it's more important to make headway in our own house. By the time the system comes into play, the damage is done. I was in Chicago a couple of four weeks ago, and we saw these little kids on bikes with masks on the side of their head, like five or six of them. And the driver said, yeah, they're little yummies. I said, who? He said, little yummies. Look up. Google Lil Yummy. Lil Yummy was an 11-year-old murderer.
Wow.
And he got murdered at 11 by a 14-year-old.
Wow.
Who's doing life now.
I wish politicians would look out for minors, and not just minors on an island somewhere. Lord, we got folks in the street, ain't got nothing to heat, and the obese milking welfare.
This problem of the role of the elite, the insulation of the elite, is one that concerns me increasingly in the United States today. As I look at social trends in the U.S. in the last 15 years, it seems to me that the wealthier people, the politicians in the United States, have succeeded increasingly in insulating themselves from the broader problems of American society, and as a result are separated from the consequences and less motivated to solve society's problems.
Polarization is evident in the increasing gap in animosity between the Democrats and the Republicans, the liberals and the conservatives, and the urban and the rural areas. One of the consequences of America's political and social polarization is gridlock. The inability and unwillingness of the political institutions such as Congress, the judiciary, and the executive branch to function effectively and efficiently and to solve the problems and needs of the people can have serious consequences for America's citizens. Gridlock is caused by various factors, such as the lack of trust and cooperation, abuses of power and procedures, political tactics like obstruction and filibuster, as well as other means through the powers of the veto or impeachment. Gridlock is evident in the frequent stalemates and shutdowns, the low approval and productivity ratings, and the high turnover and vacancy rates of the political institutions. One of the examples of America's polarization is the 2020 presidential election. The 2020 election was one of the most contentious and controversial elections in the history of America, which involved a record number of voters, candidates, and lawsuits. The election was marred by allegations of fraud, violence, and election interference, which were amplified by COVID-19, and ongoing social justice protests. The election results were contested by both sides, and the transition of power was delayed and disrupted. America's polarization is a serious problem that threatens the stability and prosperity of the nation. However, the instability could be addressed and resolved by various measures, such as restoring the trust and civility in the public discourse, enforcing the rule of law, and enhancing the education and media literacy of the citizens. On the economic front, America faces several challenges in 2024 and beyond, such as inflation, healthcare costs, violent crime, and geopolitical tensions. According to a Pew Research Center survey, inflation is the top problem for the country, with 70% of Americans saying it's a very big problem. The affordability of healthcare is another area of concern, with 55% of Americans saying it's a very big problem. Violent crime is also seen as a big problem by 54% and 51% of Americans, respectively. Russia's invasion of Ukraine, which occurred in February 2022, will have an ongoing impact on America's allies and may lead to future military conflicts. According to a Harvard Business Review article, the U.S. could face higher oil prices, lower consumer confidence, and reduced trade and investment flows because of the crisis. The article also warns that the Fed may have to tighten monetary policy more aggressively to contain inflation, which could trigger a recession. America's political and social divisions hamper the ability of the government to address the nation's problems. The Pew Research Center survey found that the public is more likely to agree with the Democratic Party on issues such as climate change, health care, and abortion, but more likely to agree with the Republican Party on issues such as the economy, crime, and immigration. The survey also found that the ability of the Republicans and Democrats to work together is one of the few issues on which there is no partisan divide, with 53% of Americans saying it's a very big problem. As America faces many uncertain situations with multiple economic, political, and security challenges, the outcome will depend on how the government and the public respond to them. For example, America's military faces several challenges ranging from traditional threats such as China and Russia to declining recruitment. Other potential military challenges include technological advancements by China and Russia. China has been developing and testing hypersonic missiles, nuclear weapons, and other advanced technologies that pose a threat to America and its allies. China also claims sovereignty over Taiwan, a democratic island that America supports. Russia, meanwhile, has invaded Ukraine and annexed Crimea, and these events are provoking a potential future military crisis in Europe. Russia also possesses a large nuclear arsenal and cyber capabilities that could disrupt America and its allies. Biothreats such as pandemics, bioterrorism, and biological warfare are also a serious concern for America's military, as they can harm the health and morale of the troops as well as the civilian population. Additionally, the military is facing the shrinking and less qualified pool of potential recruits, which could be an ongoing problem that may not have a short-term solution. According to the Pentagon, only 29% of Americans aged 17 to 24 years old meet the basic eligibility requirements for military service, such as physical fitness, education, and criminal background. Moreover, the military faces competition from the private sector, which offers higher wages, better benefits, and more flexibility to young workers. The Roman and American militaries are both examples of formidable forces that shape the course of history. Both have a body meant to represent the common people, both have an executive that controls the military, and both have codified laws and court systems. Each also included a strong sense of patriotism, honor, and duty, which have influenced the culture, language, and values of many other nations. But there are also significant differences between the Roman and American empires in terms of their origins, structures, strategies, and challenges. The Roman Empire was a political entity that encompassed a vast territory spanning from Britain to Egypt and from Spain to Syria. The Roman Empire was founded by a city-state that gradually expanded its power and influence through conquest and diplomacy, while America was founded by a group of colonies that rebelled against their imperial ruler and declared their independence. The Roman Empire and American empires also have different organizational structures and command systems. The Roman Empire was divided into provinces, each governed by a governor appointed by the emperor, who had absolute authority over the military and civil affairs. America is divided into branches, which separates the power of the government. The president is the commander-in-chief of the armed forces, but is subject to the checks and balances of the Congress and Supreme Court. The Roman and American militaries also have different strategies and tactics. The Romans had a professional army of legionnaires who were recruited from the citizenry and served for 25 years, receiving land and pensions upon retirement. The Roman Empire also relied on its superior discipline, training, equipment, and engineering to defeat its adversaries. America's military has a voluntary force of soldiers who are recruited from the population and serve for varying terms, receiving pay and benefits during and after their service. The military relies on its superior technology, intelligence, and logistics to defeat its enemies using air power, precision weapons, and special operations to strike at key targets. The Roman Empire also built roads, bridges, forts, and aqueducts to facilitate its movement, supply, and communications. America's military also engages in infrastructure projects by building bases, airports, ports, and networks to support its operations, transportation, and communication. The Roman Empire and American militaries also have different challenges and threats, but some similarities as well. The Roman Empire faced external enemies who challenged its borders and security. America also faces external enemies who challenge its interests and allies. The Roman Empire faced internal enemies such as rebellions, civil wars, and corruption that weakened its cohesion and stability. America also faces internal enemies such as terrorism and polarization that undermine its unity and trust. The Roman Empire also faced some environmental and social problems such as plagues, famines, and inflation that reduced its population and prosperity. America also faces environmental and social problems that affect its health and welfare. America is a global leader and innovator in science and technology and produces many Nobel laureates, patents, and publications. However, its scientific output and impact are challenged by emerging competitors such as China and India, who invest more in research and development. According to the 2020 Nature Index, which measures the high-quality research output of countries and institutions, America ranked first in the world for the number of articles published in top journals, but second to China for the share of articles. According to the 2020 Chicago Journal and Country Rank, which measures the scientific influence and collaboration of countries and regions, America ranked first in the world for the number of documents, citations, but fourth for the citations per document. America also has a well-developed and prestigious education system, especially at the high level, which attracts many international students and scholars. However, its students' test scores in math and science are below the global average and are behind many other developed countries. According to the 2023 Best Countries Report, America ranked first in the world for education based on a survey for more than 17,000 people. However, according to the 2018 Program for International Student Assessment, America ranked 30th in math and 11th in science out of 79 countries based on the performance of 15-year-old students. America also experiences many social issues such as homelessness, high healthcare costs, and issues with students underperforming in its education system. Although America is one of the most powerful and influential countries in the world, its performance in various fields is not always consistent or superior. Additionally, it is difficult to overlook America's seemingly deteriorating social conditions as an indicator of decline.
A long, long time ago, I can still remember how that music used to make me smile.
Well, you spoke several times before about ideological subversion. That is a phrase that I'm afraid some Americans don't fully understand. When the Soviets use the phrase ideological subversion, what do they mean by it?
Ideological subversion is the slow process which we call either ideological subversion or active measures, активные мероприятия in the language of the KGB, or psychological warfare. What it basically means is to change the perception of reality of every American to such an extent that despite of the abundance of information, no one is able to come to sensible conclusions in the interests of defending themselves, their families, their community, and their country. It's a great brainwashing process which goes very slow, and it's divided in four basic stages.
All right, this story is horrific, and it is really tough to hear. A father and his two young children killed at the hands of an illegal immigrant who we just learned will basically get a slap on the wrist for those three precious lives that were lost. He's going to spend just 2 years in jail for that crime.
Startling new report detailing decades of sexual abuse in Baltimore. Prosecutors say more than 100 officials in the Catholic Archdiocese abused more than 600 young people over 80 years. Church leaders covered it up.
February made me shiver with every paper I deliver.
Here's a sign of societal decay, another sign that our civilization is in serious decline. Have a look at this footage from the subway in New York City where a man in the white jacket and black leggings is rampaging on a train. Looks like there are plenty of able-bodied men around watching. He targets a woman, sits next to her, and begins to assault her. What do you think happened next? Did the men on the train step in and protect this woman from a violent thug? Did someone bother yelling at him to stop to show there was more of them than him? Well, no.
The first one being demoralization. It takes from 15 to 20 years to demoralize a nation. Why that many years? Because this is the minimum number of years which requires to educate one generation of students in the country of your enemy, exposed to the ideology of the enemy. In other words, Marxism-Leninism ideology is being pumped into the soft heads of at least three generations of American students without being challenged or counterbalanced by the basic values of Americanism, American patriotism. The demoralization process in the United States is basically completed already.
Bad news on the doorstep. I couldn't take one more step.
Every day brings another story about the depth of this country's opioid crisis. Overdoses up, emergency services overwhelmed, another family burying a loved one.
The next stage is destabilization. This time, subverter does not care about your ideas and the patterns of your consumption. Whether you eat junk food and get fat and flabby doesn't matter anymore. This time, and it takes only from 2 to 5 years to destabilize a nation, it's what matters is essentials: economy, foreign relations, defense systems. And you can see it quite clearly that in some areas, in such sensitive areas as defense and economy, the influence of Marxist-Leninist ideas in the United States is absolutely fantastic. I could never believe it 14 years ago when I landed in this part of the world that the process will go that fast.
So the key moment in fentanyl's emergence is the North American opioids crisis. Can we look at how that kind of drove the explosion of synthetic opioids?
The only two major countries that have ever had a fentanyl problem are the US and Canada. What US and Canada have in common is that we had this opioid overprescription crisis. And so we've all heard about the Sackler family, Purdue Pharma, overprescribing opioids like OxyContin. And that set the table for millions of new opioid users. When their prescriptions ran out, they found themselves addicted to opioids. And so they filled this craving the only way they could, which was by buying heroin on the street. And eventually there was basically not enough heroin to meet this demand. And so fentanyl basically rushed in to fill this void. And before long, there was a point where you couldn't find any heroin that wasn't cut with fentanyl.
But something touched me deep inside the day the music died.
A controversial children's book teaching graphic sex acts, complete with illustrations, making the rounds in school libraries and classrooms across the country, leaving parents and communities outraged. One concerned pastor tried to read the book at a school board meeting, but officials asked him to stop. Here's what he had to say about that.
If you don't want to hear it in a school board meeting, why should children be able to check it out of the school system? You see, we have perverts that are perverting our kids. And you all sit back smug in your chairs and celebrate diversity, equity, and inclusion, but you don't want me to read it so you can hear it.
These men are five of nearly 85,000 people who filed sexual abuse claims against the Boy Scouts of America and are part of the organization's ongoing bankruptcy case.
ESG is a social credit system that scores companies according to whether or not they're abiding by the new vision for American capitalism. So it's the scoring system for stakeholder capitalism. Think about it as a social credit system. It stands for environmental, social, and governance factors. And it refers to a new template that companies have to use in addition to the old templates they used to use to decide how they allocate capital in their businesses, how they build their businesses, how they hire people, how they invest in new projects, how they invest in other companies, to say that it no longer is just the long-run profitability of those projects that matters, but that it is also an added matrix of environmental, social, and governance factors that need to be taken into account. That's a fancy way of saying actually certain progressive political agendas, how do we weave that into our allocation of capital itself? Not necessarily through government, but through the private sector itself.
The next stage, of course, is crisis. It may take only up to 6 weeks to bring a country to the verge of crisis. You can see it in Central America now.
So bye bye, Miss American Pie. Drove my Chevy to the levee, but the levee was dry. Them good old boys were drinking whiskey and rye, singing this'll be the day that I die.
Bud Light is trying to regain its spot as America's top-selling beer after sales dropped 23% last month compared to the same period last year. Analysts blame the plunge on a Bud Light ad posted on social media by a transgender TikTok star.
So one of the books I found, the second book that I looked into, was called Call Me By Your Name.
These parents of a high school student came before the board to complain about two books specifically. One about a 17-year-old boy who has an affair with a man. The other, a story about three homeless kids, one who's been sexually abused.
All new tonight, call her Admiral. Former State Health Secretary Dr. Rachel Levine making history again. She is now the first female and openly transgender four-star officer with the U.S. Public Health Service Commissioned Corps.
That's not how it used to be. that came from you and me. Oh, and while the king was looking down, the jester stole his thorny crown.
As founder of the American Birth Control League, which later became Planned Parenthood, Margaret Sanger was no doubt a controversial figure with disturbing views on eugenics, race, and population control. While some argue she even wanted to exterminate the black race, others are trying to erase that part of her past.
And after crisis, with a violent change of power, structure, and economy, you have so-called the period of normalization. It may last indefinitely. Normalization is a cynical expression borrowed from Soviet propaganda. When the Soviet tanks moved into Czechoslovakia in 68, Comrade Brezhnev said, "Now the situation in brotherly Czechoslovakia is normalized."
Oh, and there we were, all in one place, a generation lost in space, with no time left to start again.
I want to play this clip that's embedded into the story right now. This is the ROTC. They're telling them that they have to wear high heels, I guess, so that they would identify with feminists.
I met a girl who sang the blues and asked her for some happiness, but she just smiled and turned away. I went down to the sacred store where I'd heard the music years before, but the man there said the music wouldn't play.
This is what will happen in the United States if you allow all these schmucks to bring the country to crisis, to promise people all kind of goodies and the paradise on earth, to destabilize your economy, to eliminate the principle of free market competition, and to put a big brother government in Washington, D.C. Your leftists in the United States, all these professors and all these beautiful civil rights defenders, they are instrumental in the process of the subversion only to destabilize the nation. When their job is completed, they are not needed anymore. They know too much. Some of them, when they get disillusioned, when they see that Marxist-Leninists has come to power, obviously they get offended. They think that they will come to power. That will never happen, of course. They will be lined up against the wall and shot.
Singing, this'll be the day that I die.
According to different sources and criteria, America ranks differently in academics, science, and the economy. For example, America does not perform as well in other measures of education, such as math and science scores. According to a Business Insider report in 2018, it ranked 38th in math scores and 24th in science among 71 countries. As detailed earlier, America, as a modern superpower, faces similar challenges of maintaining an empire as the Romans, and they also have many differences in their founding, their structure, and political systems. So, now the question is, could America follow a similar path of decline to that of the Romans, which will culminate in the fall of the American empire? None of us have a crystal ball to see into the future, but perhaps we can speculate about current trends in our society, the government, and the economy, reference the examples laid out in this episode, and come up with some possible scenarios. The first one might be political collapse. In this scenario, America suffers from a political collapse due to a loss of trust in its institutions, leaders, and values. America's government becomes dysfunctional as the polarization between the two major parties, the influence of money and special interests, and the manipulation of information and elections undermine the legitimacy and effectiveness of the government. America's constitution becomes increasingly irrelevant as the executive branch usurps the power of the legislative and judicial branches and violates the rights and freedoms of the citizens. The union becomes unstable as the states and regions become more divided and autonomous, and some even seek to secede from the Union. American leadership becomes erratic as the president becomes increasingly authoritarian, paranoid, and incompetent, and faces resistance and rebellion from the military, the bureaucracy, and the public. This scenario is similar to what happened to the Roman Empire when it faced a series of civil wars, coups, and assassinations that weakened its central authority and cohesion. The Roman emperors became more despotic, oppressive, and insane, and lost the loyalty and support of the army, the Senate, and the people. How likely is this scenario? Well, I guess according to some of America's critics, it's already showing signs of political decay and crisis, and could be heading towards a constitutional breakdown or even a civil war. However, others argue that America still has a strong and resilient political system that can adapt and reform itself, and the American people still share a common identity and destiny. Another scenario could be economic collapse. In this scenario, America suffers from an economic collapse due to a loss of competitiveness, productivity, and innovation. America's economy becomes stagnant as the growth of the debt deficit and inflation outpaces the growth of income, output, and trade. America's currency becomes worthless as the confidence in the dollar and role as the global reserve currency erodes. The American society becomes impoverished as the gap between the rich and the poor widens and the middle class shrinks. The infrastructure becomes dilapidated as the investment in education, health, and transportation declines. This scenario is comparable to when the Roman Empire faced a series of economic crises that reduced its wealth and prosperity. The Roman currency became debased as the emperors minted more coins with less silver and gold. Roman society became unequal as the elite accumulated more land and slaves, as the masses became dependent on bread and circuses. The infrastructure became neglected as the roads, aqueducts, and buildings deteriorated. How likely is this scenario? According to some economists, America is already experiencing an economic decline and stagnation and could be facing a financial meltdown or a hyperinflation. However, others argue that America has a diverse market, a dynamic economy that is capable of recovering the same way it had from a previous depression as well as several recessions, and that it still retains the capacity for innovation. A third scenario could be military collapse. In this scenario, America suffers from a military collapse due to a loss of power, influence, and security. America's military becomes overstretched as it engages in endless and costly wars and interventions around the world without a clear objective or outcome. The military becomes outmatched as it faces more sophisticated and aggressive adversaries such as China and Russia, who challenge its dominance and interests. The military eventually becomes unreliable as it suffers from low morale, discipline, and loyalty, and faces corruption, scandals, and defections. The Roman Empire faced a series of military defeats and disasters that exposed its vulnerability and weaknesses. The Roman army became overextended as it had to defend a vast and porous frontier and deal with internal and external threats. Over time, their army became outclassed as it faced more formidable and barbaric enemies who invaded and plundered its territory. Eventually, the Roman army became disloyal and more mercenary, mutinous, and rebellious, and supported rival claimants to the throne. How likely is this scenario? Well, America is already facing a decline in recruitment as it continues to overextend itself by deploying in various ongoing conflicts around the world, which over time could result in it losing its edge and credibility as a global military power. However, America still has a superior and unmatched military that can deter and defeat any potential enemy, as well as a network of allies and partners that share its values and interests. The last scenario I'll cover is Balkanization. The year is 2031, and America is no longer a united nation. but a fragmented and divided collection of states and regions, each with its own government laws and alliances. The process of disintegration began in the aftermath of the 2024 presidential election, which was marred by allegations of fraud, violence, and election interference. The election results were contested by both sides, and the Supreme Court was unable to resolve the dispute. The country was plunged into a constitutional crisis, and the federal government lost its legitimacy and authority. The crisis was exacerbated by the ongoing domestic polarization and a series of economic downturns which eroded the social fabric and confidence of the country. The federal response to the economic downturns was ineffective and inconsistent, and the states took matters into their own hands, imposing their own economic reforms and policies. The culmination of these events also exposed and widened the existing inequalities, divisions, and grievances in the country along racial, ethnic, religious, cultural, and ideological lines. The crisis was further inflamed by the rise of domestic and foreign threats such as terrorism, cyber attacks, and nuclear proliferation. The federal government was unable to protect the country from these threats, and the states and regions sought their own security and defense agreements, often in conflict with each other. The country also faced increasing pressure and competition from other global powers such as China, Russia, and Iran, who exploited the weaknesses and chaos of the United States to advance their own interests and agendas. The crisis reached a breaking point following the election when a second civil war erupted in the country, pitting the states and regions against each other and against the federal government. The war was brutal and bloody and lasted for several years, with no clear winner or resolution. The war also involved the intervention of external actors who supported different factions and causes and sought to gain influence and control over the territory and resources of America. The war ended in 2029, not with a peace treaty or a reunification, but with a de facto dissolution of the Union. The states and regions declared their independence or joined new confederations based on their political, economic, military, and cultural preferences. The federal government was reduced to a powerless and irrelevant entity, with no authority or recognition over the former United States. The country was effectively balkanized, and the world witnessed the fall of the American Empire. While we can look to historical examples for answers as to why empires rise and fall, what if there is also a deeper reason for decline other than mismanagement of resources, corruption, and political instability? I would be remiss if I didn't touch on some of the potential deeper instinctive factors. Specifically, what if how we're wired plays some sort of a part in the rise and fall of empires? What if, under the right circumstances, society is predisposed to imploding on itself? In the 1960s and 1970s, an American scientist named John B. Calhoun studied animal behaviors and conducted experiments intended to observe the effects of overpopulation and overcrowding on the social behavior of mice. He created a series of enclosed habitats he called universes. The mice were provided with unlimited food, water, and nesting materials, but limited space. Four pairs of mice were introduced into each universe to observe their population growth and behavior over time. As a result of the experiments, Calhoun found that as the population density increased, the mice exhibited various abnormal behaviors such as aggression, violence, cannibalism, hypersexuality, withdrawal, apathy, and neglect of offspring. He also noticed that some mice, which he called the beautiful ones, isolated themselves from the rest of the population and spent most of their time grooming, eating, and sleeping. They did not engage in any social activities, and they lost the ability to interact with other mice. Calhoun concluded that the mice had reached a state of something he described as behavioral sink, whereas the mice couldn't cope with the stress and complexity of their environment. He also suggested that his experiments had implications for human society, as he saw parallels between the mice and the urban population, and that human civilization could face a similar fate.
Of the strange research to come out of mid-1900s America, there is little with a legacy as enduring or as terrifying as the Mouse Utopia experiments. Taking place throughout the 50s, 60s, and early 70s, the grim fate of the subjects was published in the national magazine Scientific American, and the experiments themselves were largely taken as apocalyptic portents. In a post-war United States, the language used to describe the results, such as behavior sink, became synonymous with fears of an overpopulated world and violent, deviant behavior in cities.
2.5 years ago, we found Dr. John Calhoun knee-deep in mice in the mouse heaven he designed for the National Institute of Mental Health Animal Center near Washington. Dr. Calhoun wanted to find out what would happen to a mouse colony given everything mice need except living space. The result was chilling. 2.5 years ago, more than 2,000 mice were packed into Mouse City. Today, a tiny handful of survivors huddles in one corner of the city. Dr. Calhoun explains what the overcrowding did to Mouse City's inhabitants.
The last 1,000 animals born never learned to develop the social behaviors. They never learned to be aggressive, which is necessary in defense of home sites. They never learned to court, so there was no mating. Being no mating, there were no progeny, and the older animals, whose behavior was already becoming disrupted, they eventually reached an age too old to reproduce. And so it was all left up to these last 1,000 or so, whom we call the beautiful ones, because not engaging in any stressful activity and only paying attention to themselves, they groomed themselves well, so they looked very fine specimens. But from that point on, which was about the time that you were here 2.5 years ago, this reproduction totally ceased, and the animals have just aged and died.
At least one human group, the Eat tribe, discovered in Africa by Dr. Colin Turnbull, has gone through a similar terrible process, according to Dr. Calhoun.
The two conditions that they went through was that there was a decision on the then colonial government to make a wildlife preserve of this big valley, which was their home with their hunter-gatherers. They were moved up onto the mountainside and gathered together in much higher densities that had been spread out in small groups, all placed in one place, and also required to engage in an entirely different way of life, in which their social roles, the whole, everything they learned how to do had no meaning. Under those conditions, the social behavior broke down entirely. They began living. They still lived together, but their activities were just directed towards themselves. Everything you would think that's human disappeared.
Perhaps the most chilling conclusion from his Mouse City studies, says Dr. Calhoun, is that once this change in social behavior occurs, it apparently cannot be reversed.
It's this fact of apparent irreversible phase shifts that gives some of us a particular concern over the fate of the human situation, because we see worldwide the breaking down of social roles, the increase in contact, both as a result of the breakdown of social roles and because there are too many people, that this might lead to an overriding of our controls, of our total culture, and would be set into a process which would either fix us rigidly forever into some sort of global tribalism without any adaptation to change, or that would result, perhaps, eventually some decline, very much like we've seen here, but that postponed somewhat.
Dr. John B. Calhoun, with a very sobering look at a possible future for us.
As we can see, there are many similarities as well as differences between the two empires. The point here is not to attempt to prognosticate the fall of America, but to understand the state of our country and hopefully learn from past examples of the pitfalls other empires experienced so we can better our society. For those concerned with America's decline and want to find a way to avoid it, perhaps the answer isn't so complicated. Maybe it's in the form of an American Renaissance through deep examination of ourselves, our society, and revisiting what it means to be an American, what it means to be a patriot, and revisiting our common values and goals. Sometimes I wonder if after our society is long gone, will someone else come along and discover the ruins of our empire? Will they excavate our buildings and discover our engineering feats, and write books about our rise, our culture, our contributions to humanity, our decline, and ultimately our fall? Or will there even be enough remnants of our empire to give a glimpse into our lives and achievements? Will we be among many before us who seemingly just disappeared, and when trying to figure out what an American empire may have been like, leave more questions than answers? Will it leave those who discover us through archaeological operations find themselves in the same position as we are currently, wondering what their place in nature and the universe is? Perhaps all we've built, accomplishments in our history, all the advancements and innovations, will only serve as a marker that we were once here. For now, the issues facing America are complex, require complex answers, and serious people to address our challenges. There are some who might argue that with all the problems and issues ahead of us, that things like voting don't matter. I respectfully disagree with anyone making that argument. Even if the deck seems stacked against you, engaging in our civic duties still matter. If you don't participate in our government and our society, then schmucks who have taken control of our government and institutions will push us over the edge and into the abyss of fallen empires. For those who consider themselves patriots, if you really want to honor our country and our veterans, those who have put everything on the line, as well as paid the ultimate sacrifice with their lives, then don't walk up to them in a Walmart or a gas station and offer them platitudes by thanking them for their service. Thank them by doing your civic duty, by getting involved in your communities, your local and state governments, and vote. Don't leave important matters up to others in hopes that they have America's best interests in mind. Throughout our nation's history, many people died for us to have the right to vote, to have a right for something as simple as to voice an opinion, even if it's an unpopular one. It's a slap in the face to everyone who gave their lives for this country to ignore the civic duty of voting. If you want an American Renaissance, and you truly want to honor those who risked everything, that's the first step. Too many times when some unjust event happens in this country, I hear people ask, where are the veterans, and why aren't they doing anything? My question and response is, where are the citizens, and why aren't they acting? The veterans did their part. They completed their service honorably and did everything we asked of them, and did it in the most austere conditions without protest. If we really care about finding solutions to our most complex problems, then the service of America's citizens have just begun, and we have a long road ahead of us if we intend on preserving this country for our posterity and honoring those who enlisted to protect it. So we better step it up. That's all I have for this episode. Thank you for listening, and if you enjoyed this podcast, please subscribe, rate, or write a review.
There is a signal broadcast every second of every day through our television sets.
Mark my words, AI is far more dangerous than nukes.
Science and technology are propelling us forward at accelerating rates.
Engines throttling up, three engines now at 104%.